Good morning. So, as you hopefully know, we have an exam coming up soon, as in Thursday, which will be in this lecture. I will not be here and Samira will not be here. Some TAs will be proctoring the exam since we're both out of town. And today I'm going to do exam review. This is mostly going to be what questions you have. If you don't have any questions, this will be very short. Probably don't want that. So it is. First, one thing that I was informed people were confused by from TAs. So I'll go over this question. So we were asking, we wanted to build a CPU that does knock and add. And question is, which of these places are we going to need muxes? And we're thinking about doing knock and add. The assumption we wanted to have, which I think was the biggest point of confusion here, was that, was first thinking about the instruction format. That presumably we're going to have something like Y86, since that's usually what we've been assuming in this class, where our knock instruction, we have something like this. We have just some static stuff. This is our knock on Y86. And our add instruction, we're going to have some other opcode and first byte, which says, what kind of instruction is this? Because that was our convention in Y86. And then we're going to need space for two register numbers. So RA and RB. Now we could have done some different things. We could have decided that, okay, we're going to instead do something where we make these instructions the same length, but that's not the design decision we've been mostly working on. So given that, let's go through each of these things. So here, if we want a mux to control the register number to read, then that we're saying that these instructions need to read different registers. And what we learned for that is that, well, conceptually, one of these instructions doesn't read anything, and one of them reads two registers. Practically speaking, it is valid to implement them in the same way where they both read two registers. And we don't care for not what those registers are, we just need to make sure we're careful later on and don't do anything with the values we read. So this is, so for this second case here, we just don't need a mux. No, so we just always read. Read, maybe ignore. The value being read. How about before the PC register's input? With this instruction format, given that I have different lengths, we're gonna have, yes, we're gonna need a mux. We're gonna be, the mux is gonna be choosing, or something like a mux. You're choosing between PC plus one versus PC plus two. Because the input to our PC register is the next value of the PC, which is going to be the instruction after this in memory. For the register number to write, we're going to need a mux, because we need either to write into RB or to write into none, which is number 15. And we have to control that with a mux. We could possibly do something funny where we like write back the same value we read, which would be extra logic in front of the value to write. But that's typically not what we're going to do. It's typically going to be easier to control the register number. Yes?
And that doesn't depend on the instruction. You're always writing RB.
So the question is, we're always writing RB. So in this case, I'm saying we're writing RB or not.
Okay.
So for, so I'm glossing over the fact that we have two inputs.
Yeah.
And there's some instructions we need to write into RA. One example is pop. So sometimes one of these inputs will also be RA. But that doesn't come up for this CPU where we only care about nop and add, we don't care about pop. But if we cared about pop, we need to say, well, somehow we need to write to RA in some case. For the value to write, we don't need something as long as we control whether we write it all with the register number, because we're either, because we can just always write the value of RA plus the value of RB. Like, that is a valid thing to input. We'll either write it or we'll send it to the register file, but the register file will say, oh, you're telling me to write to register 15, I'm not gonna do anything with that value you gave me. Thank you anyways. And then we have finally the instruction memory address input, and this is no, because the PC register has the right value all the time. So it's just always we want to get from the PC register. We don't have any other cases. We're not gonna have any other cases for that for a while. So it just always has the right value. So any questions on this example? Yes.
On the example, are there gonna be questions where there's more than one answer?
So questions on the exam, will there be questions for the more than answer? We will try not to do that. We don't do that for lecture because usually having multiple answers is kind of better in lecture. But on the exam, we'll be careful to make our questions unambiguous. Sometimes we don't do so well, and we'll do something about that. On the exam, there will be an option to, the same format as before, so it's generally multiple choice. At the beginning of the exam, it says, and you should take advantage of this, that if you think you need to clarify your answer, like you think, if you read the question and say, that could be interpreted in two different ways, you can write an asterisk in your answer box and write what extra information you need. You will generally try not to do that, but you know, we're not great. These are new questions because we didn't just like copy a prior exam and giving it to you because we want to let you study from the prior exams. So that might not happen, and sometimes we've like dropped questions or maybe accepted multiple answers when we think it's ambiguous, but hopefully we've avoided that. And therefore, we wouldn't ask exactly this question. We'd ask it in a way where we'd eliminate the possibility of that, of doing that. And one way we might do that is by saying, what would happen in the design we discussed in lecture, which presumably you know is the one that's in the book, the one where we actually used the register number, we didn't do some funny trick. You never saw Samira do some funny trick with that, even though it's a possible thing to do. Yes?
For C and D, what are the corresponding registers in HCL?
What are the corresponding things in HCL? So the question is, what are these signals in HCL?
Yeah.
So this, so here, these are, so register number to write, this would be reg dest E and M, and this would be reg, the input would be reg input E and M. By the way, on the exam, we will not ask you any questions which would be answered by just looking up the list of signals in HCL, because that's what homework assignments are for. We reserve the right to like describe a circuit with HCL, so you want that level of understanding, but we don't want you like, what is, like, is this valid HCL code, or does it not compile? We don't want that sort of thing. Yes? The question is, will there be select all that apply questions on the exam? Yes. We have tried to format all of them so they're four checkboxes rather than write all the letters in the blank, which is what I've been doing for the past semester. More actually because this makes my TAs grade it better, because a lot of my TAs forget that there are select all that apply questions and don't give partial credit correctly, and that's a real pain when I have to like regrade like a whole question. But so they'll be more obvious than maybe some prior exams, but we will have questions of that sort. Okay, so that's the prepared portion I have. So I will take questions for the next time, and I'm going to try to just take a whole bunch of questions and then answer them in some hopefully kind of logical order. So who has questions? Like, they can be specific questions, they can be less specific questions, like, I just don't, can you go over some specific thing, rather than, can you go tell me how to solve this particular old question? Yes? Y86 stages?
Yeah.
Okay. Other, yes?
Question one on the most basic basis, instead of the following HDLRS tools, like register and
okay, it's still tracing on most recent quiz. Okay. Other, yes?
I have two questions. One is on Prelude Sounds about casting a character into an int and the digital comparison. Like,
casting char to int and comparing.
And then the other one is, there's one example, there's an example in which you have the assembly code and then the machine code to the left. And it asks you to read the, to do a memory to register move, and then like it resulted in big endian as opposed to little endian.
Okay, so endianness when from memory move queue. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Type def struct,
okay. Object file versus executable. Linking, okay. Back there. So assume I do not have any questions memorized, especially not by their number.
It walks through a Y86 program that's corresponding to machine code.
Code and outputs. Okay. Yes.
Encoding and decoding of
Y86. Encoding, decoding Y86. Okay. Yeah.
Just like, what isn't
going to
be covered on the exam?
okay. yes.
Can you give certain Y86 instructions, what they set values of?
Okay, Y86 instructions and the read and write register file inputs. Yes?
Could you also go over the address inputs and data inputs and data memories for different Y86 instructions?
Okay. And register file. Okay, other, yes?
Can you maybe differentiate what's clocked and what waits a certain.
Okay. Yes.
Can you talk about MR move Q and why it needs to use source RB?
MR move Q and RB, okay. Okay. Any other topics? I'll probably, yeah.
Can you give an example of a micro architecture?
Okay, what is a microarchitecture? Okay. Yeah?
Can you go over the, especially when you're calling something into memory?
Sorry, could you say that again?
The endianness.
Endianness, okay. Which I believe was. Right up here, yeah. Line 4. Yeah, so endianness and generally. Yeah. Okay, push pop, call ret. Anything in particular about how they're implemented?
Stages.
Okay. Bit masks. Okay. Other topic. Yes. Instruction set designs? Yeah. So ISA trade-offs. Okay, so let's organize these. We have a bunch of questions on stages. We have coding, decoding. We have a bunch of questions on how machine code works. We have some questions about ISA design. We have architecture. I guess we'll group that together. This probably goes with that. A bunch of C stuff, object file, bit mask, forbidden. So, okay. So let's start with the question of things which aren't on the exam, which I will use to possibly, to partially dispose of this. So we don't want you to memorize HCL signal names. The Y86 encoding figure, but you should know what fields instructions have. Like, we don't want you to memorize which is RA, which is RB. We will tell you if you need to know, but you should know they have an opcode, they have some register numbers, they have an immediate, their variable length. You should know what's in the instruction. You should know, like, if I added a new instruction and wanted to encode it the same way, like what fields would it have? But we aren't going to ask you, like, what bytes is the destination in for a jump instruction? Like, you would look that up in the real world. We're going to expect you to do that. And like, if you notice, we had questions with machine code. We gave you the machine code, and we told you what it was. We didn't expect. Weren't playing like tricks where that's not really an MR move Q. Ha ha. Not good for anyone. So those are things that won't be on the exam. We won't have you write HCL code. That's what homeworks are for. We might have you read HCL code, but you won't write it. Okay. And I think that, I'm not sure if that's what was being asked about encoding Y86, but okay. So Y86 stages. So the key thing to remember about the stages are this is a way our textbook organizes the CPU. Right now, they don't mean anything physically. There's nothing, no physical manifestation of the stages. They're just a way of organizing the CPU that doesn't actually affect how it runs. It's just a way of organizing it for designing it. And the stages are fetch, which probably should be called fetch and decode, which is where we read instruction memory, compute instruction length, i.e. valp, the next instruction address, and split the instruction. Then we have decode, which probably should be called register read, where we read the register file. We have execute, which is finally named kind of correctly, where we perform an ALU operation. We have memory, where we perform a data memory operation. And write back, where we write the register file. And then PC update, where we write the PC. And when we say write, we really mean set the input so the write will happen. Set up the inputs so read happens or write will happen. Because they don't actually happen in this order, but when we're saying we're writing the instruction, the data memory, what we're saying is that we set the memory write enable bit, and we set the address input, and we set that input. We wire that all up so that works, but so the write will happen. It doesn't actually happen in this order. And here, this is set up the PC register input. Okay. So any questions on stages? So, yes.
Are you going to post these notes?
Yes, these notes will be posted. There will also be a screen recording. Yeah. So right now, since the stages don't mean anything physically, it doesn't matter. After this exam, in our following class, we will talk about something where we're going to make these stages have a more physical realization, and then we'll talk about what actually ends up happening physically. Okay, so push, pop, rec, call, and seek stages. So in fetch, we read RSP and maybe another register. So all these stack manipulation instructions, they need to read RSP. RSP doesn't appear in the instruction, too bad, we still need to read it. In decode. We read RSP and maybe another register. In fetch, we do what we've done for like MRMoveQ, same thing. In execute, we compute the new RSP. That's what we're going to use our ALU for. And in memory, we either rewrite the stack at the current, write the stack at the old RSP, read the stack at the old RSP. Read the stack at the old RSP, or write the stack at the new RSP. So in the old RSP case, this is not address not from ALU. In the new RSP case, the address is from the ALU. Yes?
Why the maybe another register for decode?
So why maybe another register? By maybe, I mean if we have push. Okay. Is the case where we need another register. Yes? So in our list of stages, setting that up to happen is in the write-back stage. So I'm getting there. So the write-back stage means we write RSP and maybe another register, where this maybe is for pop. And then we have PC update, which is just as usual. And like with all our stages in our processor, all the writes happen at the end of the cycle. I guess I'll move this up here. Let's talk writes. Writes to registers, memory, registers any kind, happen at rising edge of clock, which you can think of as end of the cycle. Everything else happens as inputs are available. So we can think of like our ALU, we give it some values to add, and it takes a little bit of time because it's a physical thing that needs time to do things, but then it gives us our result. It doesn't care about anything other than those two inputs. But our registers and memory, they only actually change values when they have this rising edge of the clock. So we have this alternating clock signal which goes up and down, and when it goes up, that's when our register and memory actually does something with its inputs for writing. For reading, that still happens as things go on. Yes? So the difference between memory and write-back, these two stages. So here, this is set up inputs to the data memory, and the write-back is set up inputs to the register file. So we're doing conceptually the same kind of operation. Like in both cases, we're supplying something kind of like an address. For the register file, that thing is a register number, not a real memory address, and a value. And in the case of the data memory, we're supplying an actual address and a value. So we're doing the same kind of operation, but on different components. And the way our textbook authors decide to split up the stages, those are two different stages, even though they're the same kind of thing. And even though the actual write will happen at the same time. Yes?
Is it a bit unclear why you have to write another register when you call? Can you elaborate a bit more?
So why do I need to write another register when I pop? So if I do pop q rax, this writes rax and rsp. It reads from the stack, puts the value in rax, but it also needs to update rsp because we better not have the stack pointing at the same place anymore. Okay. So y86 instructions and register memory file inputs. So for reading, put in a register number or put, so for reading, figure out all the registers we need to read. And note, not necessarily all register numbers in the instruction. So what are the exceptions here? What are some examples where we don't read all the register numbers in the instructions aren't the ones we need to read? So all, yes, so yeah, e.g. RSP for call, ret, push, pop. That's not in the instruction, we still need to read it. And e.g. IRMoveQ doesn't need to read any register, for example. IRMoveQ has a register number, we don't actually need to read that. We can, it's okay, but we don't need to. Make sure all the corresponding register numbers are input to the register file. And in HCL, this would be reg source A and reg source B. And then we want to, then the corresponding 64-bit outputs are those values in the same clock cycle. So we don't wait for the clock to do anything, we just get the value like after some trivial delay. And in HCL, this is reg output A and reg output B. For, this is for the register file. For data memory, figure out the address, usually ALU result, but we saw there's an exception when the ALU is doing something else. Input the address, which this is mem adder, and set the output, and read the 64-bit output, which is mem output, in the same clock cycle. For writing, figure out register numbers we need to write. In the same way, make sure the corresponding inputs are set to them. So this is reg-dest-e, reg-dest-m in HCL, and set the 64-bit value inputs to the value to write, which is reg input E, reg input N. So e.g. ALU result for add. And for data memory, we set the write enable input to 1, and set add to figure out the address, input the address, and the 64-bit value, where our 64-bit value usually comes from a register. Yes? Making sure what? Corresponding register file inputs. So they're register file inputs for the register numbers to write. Okay. Oh, this reminds me, people ask push call and ret, and I forgot a special case for PC update for ret. So if ret, PC equals data memory output. Otherwise, normal. And I forgot to mention what value we write. So what value do we write for call? So the
immediate value that we got in the instruction.
So the immediate value we got in the instruction, and if call, that is what the value we write to the PC. PC equals immediate from instruction. But we have another, I missed something and no one pointed out for the memory stage for what we do for call, which is what value we write. We write the stack, but what value do we write? So if call, we're gonna write PC, yeah.
Correct PC.
PC plus 9. And if ret, the value we're reading is the new value, is the value that was written by call previously. I guess that's probably another part of the confusion of push call. So remember that call, we're not pushing a register value, we're pushing the next instruction address, which we get, which we computed in fetch. And in ret, we're not reading into a register, we're reading into the PC.
Why?
Why? Because we're needing to do the opposite. We want to return to the location that was written by call. So we want to read a PC plus 9 that was written earlier and send it to the PC. Because that PC plus 9 is the address after a previous call instruction, probably. I'm sorry for not figuring out I skipped over that by trying to do all the instructions at once. Any other questions about the stages? Yes.
Which instructions for writing don't specify the register, the destination register?
So what instructions for writing don't specify the destination register in the instructions? That would be the case where RSP is the exception. RSP is the register we never specify in instructions but not commonly use. Because it doesn't appear in push pull or pop, and that's a design decision our textbook authors made. Okay. Other questions on this YID6 stages and timing? Yes.
So for sequential stages, for the midterm, they're still conceptual.
They're still conceptual. Yeah.
Even were the circuits that we covered last time still conceptual as well?
These are real circuits that implement the processor. The stages are still conceptual in them because they don't affect the order things happen. Right? I could have divided it up in the same, a different way, and we still have the same circuit. Yeah.
Where is this going to be posted?
Where are these going to be posted? It will be linked off the schedule page, along with the video recordings. Okay, so HCL tracing from the most recent quiz. So let me pull up the most recent quiz on my screen. I think it was this one. Yeah, so we had this code here. I'm taking care of that. Yeah, that code, this code here, which you now can see, and we said that during cycle, we had some cycle, we had a value of YA, a value of YB, a value of XA, and a value of XB. So during cycle one, we said that YA was 1, YA was 0, YB was 0. So let's just compute during this cycle, based on what we have written here, what's XA? XA is YA plus YB, which is 0, and XB is 1. During cycle 2, what's going to happen is we have our register inputs get copied to their outputs. When we have, because in between here, we have the rising edge of the clock happens. So we have 0 and 1 as YA and YB, since those are the register outputs. And XA is 1, and XB is 2. and we axed during cycle number 3, so we go to 3, and we have 1 and 2. And we could compute more, but what we needed, the answer we asked for on the quiz was just this value. Yes?
Could we start at cycle 1 on the rising edge?
So the question said, assume we call the cycle where we have where y and yd taken their initial value cycle 1. So that was phrased to avoid confusion about the rising edge because we can't instantaneously take on a value during the rising edge. That's between rising edges.
So it's like at the top?
So it's, and like, it could be at the top or bottom, it's between two rising edges.
Okay.
So we have that value, then a rising edge happens and we're in the next cycle. And this sort of graph chart is what I recommend doing whenever you have a problem like this. And this includes the ones on exams where we've, instead of writing, giving you HCL code, we've given you drawn out a circuit with some registers and some adders. Like, use this strategy to figure out what's going on. Yes?
So I think that's what you were talking about just now. When they ask what's the value in the third clock cycle, it's before the clock cycle ends, so before the next rising edge.
Yeah. So, yeah. Clock cycles are always between two rising edges. Yes?
I'm a bit confused on how
YD can be 1. So, what we have here is we have a register such that, no, that's not the picture of the thing I wanted. Here, yeah. So we have our register, so we have YB and XB. That's what's going on with this HCL code. So here, during our first cycle, this was 0, and we did something where we added 1 and sent it to XB. So this input here was 1, and when we had our rising edge of the clock, so we had, this was the state during this time, and we had a rising edge of the clock happened, and we entered our next cycle. And in our next cycle, we just copy this value over, because that's how the register, what the register does. And now its input is 2. And so, yeah, so the value we had there during the cycle is the one that's going to be the output in the next cycle. So when I have a chart like this, I can think of that this XA value here ends up being the YA value in the, after we have a rising edge of a clock. And we just shift them over every time. Okay. So other questions about this? And so as I said, this is the strategy you should use on the tracing questions. You can see, hopefully, some of that correspondence from what I drew that's equivalent to what the HCL code I wrote here. That we won't, on those questions, typically like name the input and output, but you can just say, register A input, and make a chart. Register A output, and so on. Okay, so encoding and decoding Y86. So as I mentioned, we don't want you to memorize the figure, but the general rule is all the mediates are going to be, mediates need to appear in the machine code. The register numbers need to appear in the machine code. We try to have them in the same place. Same place for each instruction, because that makes our implementation a lot more convenient. We don't have to like look at 20 different places to find register numbers. We just look at one place for our register numbers. And we always use byte 0 to give opcode, so iCode plus function code, to tell what kind of instruction it is. Yeah.
Okay, so we can always assume that the iCode is the top nibble.
Yes, is the most significant bits of the first byte.
Okay.
Yeah, And we don't want you to even memorize that. If you need to know that, we'll tell you in some way. We'll like say, remember that the opcode appears in the most significant 4 bits of byte 0 of Y86 instruction or something like that, rather than having you memorize that figure, which is not really worthwhile. Okay, so next is about question 9 from spring 2016, which is about questions we've asked where we say something like we have some machine code and you need to look at, and we want to tell you to know, well, we have an mRemove queue which is reading machine code, and we want you to know what's going on. So let's see if I can. Next, here. So we can just. So we had something like this, I believe. And the question is, what happens here? So, first thing you should figure out is, well, let's find the easy register values. So after this IRMOVEQ instruction, RDX equals 1. And here, now RAX gets the value from memory at RDX plus 0, which is the same as memory at address 1. And this is 8 bytes, because that's what all our reads do. Also, to remind you, we have a queue in the instruction. Also, it's an R register, which is 8 bytes. So you have a bunch of ways of remembering that it's 8 bytes. So we're reading 8 bytes starting at address 1. And the setup for this, I guess it doesn't say so. When we've asked questions like this later on, we've been careful to make it even more explicit that this is a list of bytes where the first byte has the address listed. So this 30 here, this is address 0. This F2 here is at address 1, and so on. Yes?
What was the question?
So the first question that's asked here is, what's the value of RAX? What is this actual value here? I think you're just the only question which is asked. So the question is RAX equals what when this is done? And so the question that is the same as, what is 8 bytes in memory at address 1? So those 8 bytes are going to be, we're going to start at address 1, and we're going to take the next 8 bytes. So that's 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So that's what we're reading from memory. And we have a list of bytes there, but our register values are 64-bit integers. So we have to decide how to interpret a list of bytes as a 64-bit integer. And we know that Y86 is always little endian. I believe we even have a reminder at the top of the exams that assume 64-bit little endian unless we specify otherwise. Though it comes up enough that most people don't need it. So we want to interpret this as a little endian number, which means that we're going to have F2 is least significant, followed by is second least significant, and so on, etc. So the number we get is we have F2 in the least significant part, then the next least significant part is our 0, 1, and then a whole bunch of zeros. And so the actual value we have is X1F2. So any questions on this? And generally, when we ask a question where we tell you, here are bytes of memory, figure out how you read an integer from it. Just remember, it's little endian, so just list out what the bytes are. And probably it's easiest to write them in hex and know you can just order the byte hex values to get your hexadecimal number. If we want you to go the opposite way, you just write the hex number, separate it into bytes, put the bytes in order with least significant first to figure out the values of each byte, to go the other way. If we ask you, wait, what's byte 3 after we write this, for example? Yes?
Sorry, so you put the least significant and the second least significant together?
Because we're reading this, this instruction reads this. We put them together because we get one number in RAX. So we read these whole 8 bytes into RAX. And so I need to put all those bytes together somehow. So I put the least significant part, which is the first one, as it's written on this line, in the bottom, in the least significant part of my hexadecimal number. And then I put the second least significant part, 01, there. And I put all the zeros above it, but I just didn't write all of them because they're zeros, and leaving zeros won't change the value. Yes?
Yeah, so I'm a little confused. So in the memory up there, the one that's highlighted right now,
yeah.
That's in the little one. Yes.
That's in, it's just a list of bytes.
Uh-huh.
So endianness, like, it doesn't really make sense when we, like, talk about, the halt instruction. And if we had a kind of add instruction, like, you wouldn't say that's in little endian, really.
Yes, but we understand that as being a value in little endian. So when we put in the register, we want to put the actual value.
Yes.
In a number that humans can understand. That's why we turn it from little endian to big endian.
Yes, and okay. In a register, we don't have endianness because you can't. I'm not going to ask you because, like, what's byte 7 of a register? Like, that doesn't have a meaning. Because there's not like an instruction which says, put byte 7 of RAX into, you know, RBX.
Okay.
So we don't have any byte order for our registers because there's no way of knowing like what is first. So other questions? What's going on here? Yeah. That we do. Address 1, you mean? So the IRMove Q1 is setting RDX. So it sets it to 1. That's why it's address 1 and not 0 that we start at, if that's what you're asking. The MRMove Q instruction is the one which is actually reading this. So the MRMove Q instruction is reading from IRMove Q's memory. Like, this could have been, if we moved a different address, we'd be reading from a completely different part of memory. So, like, if I change this IRMoveQ to IRMoveQ 1000, we presumably just read a bunch of zeros. Because that would be what's in memory, like, way down here.
So when it says memory at address 1, is that just mean it starts at?
Yes.
And
keeps going, yes. Which is always what we're going to do when we read memory. We always give the address of the lowest part of what we're reading. We don't address integers by their middle. We could do that, but doesn't make much sense. Okay. So other questions? Here? Yeah.
What would the assembly instruction look like if we wanted to put like RDX into RDX, the actual value, not the
memory? If you wanted to put RDX the value in RAX, it would be an RRMoveQ RDX RAX. You wouldn't need the dollar sign because it's a register, not a constant.
Okay, so that's the difference.
Yeah. Okay, so MRMoveQ and RB. So our ISA needed to make a choice. Either we had DRA and DRB to compute memory locations, or some memory instructions write to RA, some write to RB. And they chose this one. And they chose the first one. That's why they do that. And this is an example of a sort of trade-off, like in the instruction set design, where they did something, they're doing things to make it easier for the implementation, they think. So ISA trade-offs generally. So most of this is it easier to implement in some way? is it easier for assemblers? Assemblers. And we had sort of the big set of trade-offs was sort of risk, which was easier to implement to CISC, which is closer to software needs. Assemblers, I guess, and compilers. So there are other sort of trade-offs we can imagine. So other trade-offs are like what kind of hardware implementations. So for example, lots of registers is more hardware, but maybe faster. You know, variable length instructions is more complicated hardware, but maybe shorter code, less space for machine code. And you have other trade-offs like that. Yeah.
So for risk and SIDS, what's the burden for optimization for each of them?
So easier to implement, but less knowledge of what code is actually doing, less for special optimizations. So generally, it's easier to implement in hardware, but that means the hardware is doing less, so it knows less about the program. Like, it doesn't know you're doing a sort, like maybe you could guess it somehow, but it's probably not gonna do something specialized to optimize your sort. It's gonna rely more on the compiler figuring all that out, because it just doesn't provide operations which tell the hardware enough about what you're doing for it to implement something specialized to optimize your particular task. Yes?
In one of the previous exams, we talked about risk and how it has better time to market something.
So time to market is how long from when we start developing something to when we actually start selling it. And if you think about being easier to implement, that's going to make it have a faster time to market. Yeah. Versus with CISC, like if we need to like test our sort instruction, that's going to take a lot of extra development time for our processor. Versus if we need to test our MR move queue instruction, that's a lot easier to make sure that works correctly. Okay, I'll try to get through this. So what is a microarchitecture? A particular implementation. So example, Y86-seq is one microarchitecture for Y86. Chooses one cycle per instruction. Chooses to use a register file with a regnone option. And these are all things that we didn't have to do. So for example, later on we'll have pipe a different Y86 microarchitecture, which it chooses about 5 cycles per instruction, but in parallel. So that's a different decision about how instructions are executed, but it's not visible to a programmer. Beyond that, the performance is different. And we could have made microarchitecture that does multiple cycles, e.g. read one register cycle only. So to execute an add instruction, we first read register A, then in the next cycle we read register B, then in the next cycle we add them, then in the next cycle we store the result. We could make a microarchitecture like that, which executes instructions very differently. That would still be an implementation of Y86. Still the same ISA, as far as a programmer, it's just a really slow CPU. Yes?
Between microarchitectures and
ACRS. So what's the difference between microarchitectures and ACRS? ACRS is a way of implementing a microarchitecture. I mean, in reality, we implement microarchitectures by building physical circuits. Yeah.
So you would always separate the microarchitecture from the ISA?
Yeah, so the ISA is what we need to know if we're building a compiler, an assembler, and a linker. and an operating system. Like it's a set we need to know for writing software overall for the hardware. So we don't need to know like how many registers do you read a cycle, we just need to know what instructions can you execute. Okay, casting caret int and comparing. I don't think we ask about this thing beyond that the warning that if we have x equals y, this will convert both to the same type, and same type if small, if large enough. And if you want to compare to, and the rule that, rule of thumb, when in doubt, cast both same type. And probably that you should also know that if you do this, the result is negative, which hopefully you remember from choose complement stuff, but maybe not. Say type def struct. So when we do struct foo, then struct foo x declares x. Struct foo, so foo x is illegal. When we do type def struct foo bar, struct foo x declares x, bar y declares y, bar y declare x declares x, same type, with the same type. Struct bar x is illegal, even if you capitalize it correctly. And foo x is still illegal. And if I do type def struct bar, I can do bar x, and that works. And struct bar still doesn't. So that's the main sort of functional difference. The other notable thing is that if I do type def struct foo star next, bar is illegal, as is bar star next is also illegal because bar not declared in time. And struct foo next, that is not illegal. That is fine. Any questions on type def struct? Yeah.
Do we have an option where you would be like instantiating the struct variable with the definition of the struct?
The question is, can I make a new struct in the same place I declare it? Yes. I don't think we'll ever do that because I find it mostly confusing, but it is legal to do in C.
But we'll not do that.
We won't do that. So object files versus executables and linking in general. So our assembly file has instruction name, instruction and register names, has labels. Our object file has machine code. We don't actually know where individual instructions are, not individual instructions, just like a mass of machine code. And it has labels. It has label locations in the file of labels that are of labels defined, which is the symbol table, and locations in the file of labels used, which are the relocations. the executable, so the executable has machine code with labels used replaced with actual memory addresses. So in the object file, could machine code, which could end up anywhere in memory. We also incidentally have data, e.g. constant strings, which again could end up anywhere in memory. And the executable has machine codes and data just ready to load, so it's basically, statically linked, basically ready to load into memory, do it anymore. So we can just load everything into memory, don't do any more work when we have an executable. Yes?
If you ask about the order of the segments in the object file, do you assume that it's like an ELF format?
The question is, if we ask about the order of segments in an object file, I promise we will not do that.
Okay.
You might want you to know there are multiple segments, like there's the machine code and the data, but we're not gonna ask you about the particular way they're stored, in large part because, well, ELF is what Linux does, it's not what like Windows does. And also ELF is lets you do multiple orders, so it's another good reason not to ask that question. Yeah.
What's the difference between statically linked and dynamically linked?
So an executable which is dynamically linked, has machine code with many labels replaced with actual memory addresses and data, and locations in the file of labels from libraries that are loaded when the executable starts. So we've done some of the linking in a dynamic linked executable. Some of these relocations are still there, and we need to handle them when we start the executable. So basically, in a dynamically linked executable, we've done part of the linking, but we haven't actually done a lot of the linking yet. We need to finish it up when we actually run the executable. We wait until basically the last possible minute. Yes? So what's the advantage of that? The advantage is, so it means libraries can change without changing the executable, is the big advantage. Also means we can have one copy of library in memory and disk for many programs that use it. So for example, we can have one copy of printf on our entire system rather than I have 1,000 executables and 1,000 copies of printf. Yes?
What's a default link in dynamic or static?
This is, dynamic is typically the default for C++. Yeah?
So when do we
When do we interpret where instructions begin and end in object files? We don't. Did I give the impression we did? Did I key a quiz question wrong? It was an option, and I think we said that wasn't stored, I hope. If I did, I need to correct that key. So that information is forgotten after the assembler runs. So the assembler needs to write down, I use this label here for the linker to care about things. The linker doesn't actually know what it's replacing labels in. It just knows you need to put an address here. That's all it's told. So if we have a whole bunch of instructions which don't use labels, the linker just says, this is a blob of bytes I'm going to put in the executable. So it could interpret the machine code, but it has no reason to. It's just going to look at where the labels are and fix them, and can copy all the bytes together without caring about how they split up into instructions into the executable. Yeah?
what exactly does a symbol, like, wouldn't a symbol table and relocation be doing the same thing?
So symbol table is labels that are defined. So these are things that other files might care about. Files to, yeah. So these are symbol table of functions used by other object files, by other object files. And the relocations is functions used in other object files. Used in other files. So the symbol table is, here are the functions that I'm defining that other files might be using. And the relocations are, here are the functions I'm using that are in other files. Yeah.
So for a symbol table, that's when you declare your functions are
extern. I guess I should say from other files. Yeah. So the symbol table is where your extern, yeah, when you declare a function extern, that's saying, so when you declare a function extern but don't actually define it, that means there's a relocation for it, but no symbol table entry that tells you where to find the code because it's not in that file. Okay, so, and finally, bit masks. So, general rule of thumb, want to select some bits, write a number with ones in the bits you care about zeros otherwise. Example, the three least significant bits, I want binary 111, which is 0x7 in hex. And then bitmap-wise operations with masks. So, and with mask, and this is what I'm going to call a mask that selects the three least significant bits. So, and with mask is keep only the selected bits. So, for example, 1 anded with 0x7 is 0x1, keeping the 0x1, which is the, you know, the three least significant bits of 0x101. So or with mask is set all these bits to 1, so 0x101, ored with 0x7 is 0x107, three least sig bits are now set, other bits unchanged. XOR with mask is flip these bits. So x101 XORed with 0x7 is 0x106. Three least bits have opposite value they had before. And what? This?
No.
Oh, yes, that should be a caret. And with the opposite of a mask is keep only the other bits, the other bit, unselected, the unselected bits. So x101 and with tilde x7 is 0x100. The three least bits are cleared. Yeah.
When you use the logical operators and so there's this short circuit thing, so one half doesn't get evaluated if the other half fills the condition.
Mm-hmm.
And that's different from when you use the bitwise
operators. Yes. Short circuit operators only evaluate what they need, only care about true or false. And always evaluates everything. Everything cares about every single bit. Yeah?
Can we talk a little bit about endianness and bitmasks?
So endianness and bitmasks, what is there to talk about? So when we have a number like, I mean, so it only matters if for some reason you are interpreting multiple bytes as an integer, which we aren't doing. We're just saying we have two integers. We know how the bits in them correspond because we know least significant bit to least significant bit, second least significant bit to least second least significant bit, and so on. We don't need to care about any of this because we aren't numbering anything, and we know exactly the, and we can write the bits and the two numbers in the same order. Yes. What is the negative operator? Which negative operator? This operator?
Yeah.
So, minus, if you remember 2's complement, this is tilde x plus 1 is the same, is flip all the bits and add 1. This is probably what you're thinking about. It's equivalent to multiplying by negative 1. That's easier. Yeah.
Is it better to use subtraction to check equality or XNOR?
So the question is, better to use subtraction or XOR? Hard to say. We're not going to ask a question where about that, mainly because you need to set up a whole bunch of assumptions to know which just makes more sense. So as I mentioned when I talked about performance of bitwise operators, on a modern processor, they're basically the same performance. In fact, I wouldn't be shocked if some processors were, in some cases, faster for a subtraction, even though it is a much more complicated operation. Just because they have more hardware to do subtractions. Yeah?
When we're going to do 101,
yeah. Why am I not doing ending with 111? So this is hex 101, which is 1001 ended with lots of leading zeros, 111. So that's what's happening in binary, if that makes things clearer. Yeah. I probably should have chosen a hex number which didn't have only ones and zeros. Okay. So I have 3 more minutes, so any topics I missed or should go, or other questions people have? Yes? So our tests are mostly multiple choice, so not as such, but we definitely want you to know if we show you some code which uses masks, like what it does and whether it does something that's equivalent to something else we might describe in words. Yes? On the test, will we specify whether right shift is arithmetic or logical? We may or may not. We will tell you about the types of the values involved, whether they're signed or unsigned. And you can remember that generally on the systems we care about, signed right shift, arithmetic, copy sign bit, unsigned right shift is logical, always zeros. Yes?
So on like one of the quizzes, I know there was one question like none of the answers were correct. Is that a possibility for the test?
Yes. Generally, we will throw out those questions as checkboxes, and it is possible that none of the answers are correct. Also, the way we grade those questions, including on the quizzes, is that each of the parts is basically graded like a separate question. So partial credit-wise, if you don't think any of them are right and you're kind of confident in that, it's probably not to your advantage to randomly choose one that must be right. Like, you're gonna get more partial credit by just choosing none. Like, you do get points for selecting nothing, even if one of them is right.
Yeah.